Hi everyone, my name is Klaatu and this is Hacker Public Radio, Urban Camping, Episode 8. This is the final episode. I think I'd said there were going to be 7 or 8 or 9, so this is it, 8, the final one. I waited a little while to do this one because I was actually getting a lot of listener feedback. To date, I think probably more listener feedback on this series than I've ever had on anything else. Aside maybe from a Blender tutorial or something, but a lot of people, it seems, kind of found this idea really either intriguing or really similar to something they were doing or whatever. I, as usual, have done a horrible job of collecting all of the things that I was supposed to collect about, you know, what they all said to me, so I'll just say that, generally speaking, people have said that it's a really neat idea, something that they would really like to try, something that they intend to try at some point. And two things off the top of my head that people mentioned were, one, that hack spaces are really, really good for an urban camping, or would be really good. And I think that is true. I've only been in real life to one hack space, and that was the one in New York, Rochester, New York area. And it was really cool, and I can imagine if I was really, really close to a hack space and it was really convenient to get to it, I would probably spend a lot of time in a hack space, probably pay the membership due or whatever, get a key, and just hang out there basically all the time, because that would be fantastic. As I said in my last episode, episode 7, that can be also a little bit of a curse, because there is that kind of, oh, I'm a geek, I don't have to go outside, I can just sit at my computer all alone and hack all day. And while that's really, really great for focus sometimes it's not so good for kind of getting your mind to be thinking out of the box and just meeting new people, which, you know, I mean, we're human, it's pretty important to do that at some point. So Hackspace could be really cool. It could be good for collaboration if there are other people hanging out there a lot as well. It could be good for social events as well if it's an active, you know, kind of busy Hackspace. So that was a great suggestion from a listener. Another listener told me about something that I'd honestly never heard of before. It's called co-working, and it's kind of an interesting thing. I don't really know much about it, but it sounds like it's a building that offers something called co-working membership, meaning that you rent, I think, like an office or a space where you can work, do all kinds of things. You get 24/7 access. The guy who told me about this says that he found a place that was $300 a month, and that essentially gets you internet connection, probably like telephone connection, I imagine. I don't know. He didn't say that explicitly. And a little space where you could, of course, since it's 24/7 access, you could actually even sleep there. And you get to meet more people. Again, it's not quite a hack space, but it's basically a hack space because there are other people there doing whatever people do in office environments or working environments. So that sounds really cool. I would have loved to know about that a long time ago, and I'm going to actually start looking for these things in my area because that sounds exactly like what I've been looking for a very long time. So that's really good to know about. Thank you very much. Everyone who's commented, it's been really great feedback, lots of cool ideas, great recommendations about different backpacks, coffee cups, all kinds of things. So that's really, really neat. Another thing that I was actually talking to the Last Known God about from the Indiana Linux Fest, which I just got back from recently, we were speaking about finding food, you know, just outside, being self-reliant enough that you can actually just feed yourself from things that you find in that strange thing called nature, whether it's mushrooms or just plants or fruit, whatever. Mushrooms you should obviously probably stay away from unless you've taken a class in it, but there are people who know a lot about it, and they can teach you that sort of thing. Plants, there's a really neat little book that my friend Scarlett got me called The Illustrated Guide to Edible Wild Plants, which was put out by the Department of the Army, actually, but she found it at an anarchist bookstore. Nice little breach of logic there. Or not really, it's just an unlikely combination, I guess. And it was put out by the Lions Press. You can find their site at lionspress.com, and it's a book with pictures and everything about all the different kinds of plants that you might find just out there in the world that you can actually chow down on. And it's a really fascinating book, and I think that kind of survivalism sort of technique. Who doesn't need that? I mean, that's just really good stuff to know. It's our planet. We live on it. We might as well know what we can eat and not eat. So check either that book out or something similar to it. It's a pretty interesting study. But in this episode, we're going to talk very specifically about hacking as an urban camper. The crowd listening to this series, are most of them, I think, are probably interested in computing, hacking, things like that. So when you think about it, the idea of being an urban camper, it's almost, again, an unlikely combination, because if you're in love with your computer and you want to be on your computer all the time, you want to be on the network all the time, how do you do that? How do you have power? How do you have access to networks all the time if you're just out and about? Well, of course, in today's world, it's not that big of a deal, and I've covered some of the things about going out and finding a good network and a good place with refillable coffee and just kind of camping out there, and that's definitely applicable, and that was, you know, that's generally what I do. But let's talk specifically about what we're doing on the computers while we're doing that, and how not to be hacked ourselves, I guess. Now, I'm no security expert. I actually know nothing about security. I just kind of know what people talk about. So I'm going to tell you what I do when I'm out on public Wi-Fi networks and things like that, to kind of give myself a layer of security. But you should come up with your own methodologies, and you should probably do more research on this and be smart. You know, just kind of use your best judgment when you're out doing things. So first of all, I mean, if you're out on a public network, that automatically right there kind of restricts what you should and should not be doing on that network. For instance, if you're checking your mail via some kind of antiquated, unsecured logins and things like, or unencrypted logins and things like that, you're sending your password in plain text, all that other good stuff. If you are doing that, you really shouldn't be doing that at all. It's a bad idea on a public network. So if you need to check your mail with these protocols, I mean, sometimes the mail provider that you're using might just, they may not give you another option, then save that for later. Save it for your friend's house. Save it for a network that you feel like you can trust a little bit more. Online banking, same thing goes. If you're doing online banking and you're on a public Wi-Fi, you probably shouldn't be doing it on that network at all, period. I would probably save that for a trusted network. Those are just two obvious rules of thumb that nevertheless people kind of violate anyway all the time. So the solutions there would be, well, twofold. Mobile banking, because of the mobile phones out there that don't do flash and things like that. A lot of the mobile banking sites nowadays will have a mobile accessible site. This is usually a much smaller and simpler version of their typical mobile banking site, and a lot of times it'll just be that little, you know, it'll be like an m.migratebank.com instead of just www.migratebank.com. So if you direct your browser to m.migratebank.com, then you'll be taken to your bank. I'm assuming we are all knowing that I mean that you need to substitute the name of your, you know, the domain of your bank for Migrate Bank. So whatever your bank is.com, you go there, and suddenly you're on a much lighter weight version of your banking site, which of course does nothing for security, right? But the other thing that I'm going to talk about right now is the part where you're tunneling stuff through more secured means. A couple of different ways to do this. You can set up an SSH tunnel to a server somewhere and then use the version of your browser over on that server. That's what I typically do. That's really the only way, to be honest, I know how to do it. It's very simple to do this, actually, but you do have to have a server. So the idea would be, of course, to set up the server in some safe location and go ahead and install some kind of X environment. It doesn't have to be fancy. It just has to be enough, essentially, to give you enough for a nice graphical browser like Firefox. Set that up. Of course, you won't be able to actually see any of it, and you don't even really have to launch the desktop, but it needs to be installed. And then when you SSH into that server, do the SSH with a -X flag. SSH -X will allow the X forwarding to occur, and then you can use the Firefox over on your server and do your mobile banking through the SSH tunnel. And since the SSH tunnel, of course, is going to be slower than a normal HTTP connection to your bank, using the mobile version of your bank's site will help you a lot. Better than that, of course, is not doing your banking on public networks. I've heard that exporting via SSH isn't exactly the best idea anyway. It's not like the most secure thing in the world. I don't know, but it's something to keep in mind. So that's how to do that, though. Now that brings me to a really important point of the fact that you probably need a server. If you're going to be doing urban camping and you're going to be hanging out on unknown networks, having that server, your own private cloud essentially, or semi-private because you probably don't actually own the hardware that you are constructing the cloud on, but having a server in some remote location where you can go, where you can access that server from any network via some kind of tunnel, probably an SSH tunnel, it's a really good idea. So, you can just use that server. I mean, for everyday surfing, I'm not saying you need to be on your little private server cloud, but for things like that, for an emergency mobile banking session or checking your email when you know that your email may not be the most secure email service around, stuff like that. For a while, at the very beginning of my really serious urban camping thing, which was last year, for really practically all of last year, I was using what I'd been using for a while, which was sdf.lonestar.org. And sdf.lonestar.org is kind of cool because it's a secure shell account. If you pay your lifetime membership of $36, you get a secure shell account. You can SSH in. You can use it as your primary or your secure email address because now you're SSHing in, so you can check all your email there. So it's a great little thing to have. It's a server. It's a cloud that you can access quite securely and use for a lot of different things. The only problem with it, I guess, is that I found it ever so slightly too slow, a little bit slower than I would have preferred, I guess. And I also found it ever so slightly, and I mean ever so slightly, unreliable. And I don't mean that sdf.lonestar.org is unreliable, because it's a great service. I love it, and I still have my account, and will continue to have my account, and continue to enjoy it. But there would be just one or two times where I would try to access them and they were moving their server. There was a big server move last year, actually. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, really, really wasn't. But I just, it kind of drove home for me that I felt like I needed something a little bit more, something I could really kind of point to and call my own and be paying for and say, hey, I want that server to be right there and online all the time, no matter where I was. So doing that meant getting a VPS, a virtual private server. And doing that alone would have been a little bit costly, perhaps, but I managed to find three other people who actually were interested in doing the same thing, having a virtual private server. And so we all kind of pitched in, and we all pay, a quarter of the server cost, and we now have our own little private-ish cloud. Again, we don't actually own the hardware, but the server is there. So I guess I don't really use this private cloud so much for the sort of common use of it, like, oh, here's my email and all my online documents and all the things that are important to me that I need to have everywhere, and here's all the things that are important to me and that I need to have everywhere. I don't really do that. I quite the contrary, I keep the stuff that's important to me off of anybody's cloud. So I don't use it for that, but I do use it as a kind of a gateway out of whatever public Wi-Fi or public network that I'm on, and out into the rest of the internet. Setting up the SSH tunnel, of course, is just as simple as I said. I mean, it's just literally just SSH with the -X flag if you need the graphical stuff, although if you don't, and quite often I don't, you can simply SSH in, use links for your web browsing, use Mutt or Pine for your email, and really whatever else you want to do on the cloud. So having that is a great idea. Finding a couple of people who you can trust, who can go into a kind of roommate situation with you on this server, on the VPS, each kind of chip in for paying the bills. It makes it really, really manageable and gets you out of the public network that you'd otherwise just be kind of a sitting duck on, and gives you a little tunnel out into the rest of the world, and gives you a little bit more security, and also kind of frees you from things, sort of the more obvious alternatives to doing that. You know, things like, well, I'm using Gmail, so it's got an HTTPS connection, so who cares? Well, no one except that Gmail has all your email anyway, so yeah, who does care? So using the server for that is not a bad idea. Disadvantage to that, so far it's only been speed. In terms of connecting to that server, I've not had a problem yet. I've not encountered a public network that blocks SSH access. for instance. I just don't run into that so far. In terms of speed, yeah, I've noticed, you know, every time I do it, practically, I notice that, yeah, I'm SSH into my server. It is slow. If you want a really nice server, it's going to cost a lot of money, and you still might not even be getting that great of a connection. It just kind of depends on what network you're on. This particular server that I'm paying part for, really, really dirt cheap, and it feels slow. It doesn't have a whole lot of RAM, no matter what network I'm on, unless I'm just getting really lucky, and I guess none of the other people actually on that physical box, you know, not my paying roommates and fellow users, but those other people out on that server who have their own little VPS partitions, you know, if they're not on it, then I'll feel like the speed is okay. But more often than not, I feel the performance hit. So that's just something to be aware of. Also, doing cool things online, of course, always, there's Tor. Tor, as you probably already know, I've interviewed, I think it was for HPR, Wendy, one of the people who is currently with Tor, or was with Tor and is now with EFF, or vice versa, or both. But she's a really smart lawyer, hacker type, and it's really cool. So we all know about Tor. It's a great project. Setting it up is surprisingly easy, and I'm talking about setting it up for the most common use, which is, oh, I'm going to browse. I want to be anonymous about where I'm coming from or what my, you know, who and what I am. Tap into Tor for that. This isn't really something that I think you're going to need so much from a public network, since public networks, by their nature, are fairly anonymous. If I'm wrong on that, you know, I mean, don't quote me, first of all, but if I'm wrong on that, and if Tor anonymizes you even more than what I'm aware of, then don't listen to me. But otherwise, I don't know. I don't tend to use it from public networks so much as I do from networks that I, you know, my friend's network or the work network, that kind of thing, where I'm there frequently, someone else owns the network, I don't want either myself or them necessarily being on the record as having gone to certain places, so you do it with Tor. Tor used to kind of confound me a little bit in terms of setting it up, because you'd see all this crazy stuff about how many options you've got for the setup, and how to configure your browser to use it automatically, and all these different buttons and plugins and Vidalia and all these other things that, frankly, I can't be bothered to even figure all that stuff out. So I'm going to tell you exactly how Tor is done on my computer. So my computer runs Slackware, so this is going to be biased toward that, but I mean, in theory, you know, if you listen to all the cliches, Slackware is really, really hard to use, so if I can do it on Slackware, you should be able to listen to how I do it and emulate it with great simplicity and ease on whatever distribution you're running. So on Slackware, this is actually straight out of the Slack build that I use in order to get all this stuff done, so it's not anything that I've actually figured out as much as it is something that I just am copying from the instructions, so it's very, very easy. The first thing that I do is install libevent, because it's a direct dependent, the Tor requires libevent, so if you install libevent on your computer, you'll have the dependency for Tor, and then you do a group add /g/220, and you call that group Tor. And we're using 220 because it's quote-unquote recommended. I don't know why it's recommended to be that, except that it's, you know, a low number, so it's kind of a system kind of user. I understand that part. I don't know why else it's recommended. Then you add a user. User add -u 220-g, meaning assign them primarily to this group, 220, which of course is the Tor group we just created, -c. You can comment, you know, make a comment like, this is the Tor user, or, you know, the Onion router, whatever. It's just a human-readable comment for yourself. -d /dev/null/s/bin/false, and then name that user Tor. So basically, you're creating a fairly powerless user in terms of logging into your system. The default shell would not be a shell. It would be /bin/false. So that wouldn't do anyone much good if they were able to somehow get into your computer with the username Tor. But Tor can use this username. And you do that, and you run the Slack build, and it installs Tor. Really as simple as that. The newest version, I think, is like, I don't know, 1.2.30 or 2.1.30, something with a 2 and a 1 and a 30 in it. It works great. It's easy to use. Once it's installed, you simply drop down to a command line and you type in the word Tor, T-O-R. If you look, if you open another terminal after you've done that, and then look at the config file, which at least on Slackware is /etc/tor/torrc. If you look at that, it tells you exactly what ports Tor is running on as the thing that you will interact with. And the default on that right now is SOX port 9050. And the address for that, since it's running on your computer that you're about to use for the connections, it would be SOX listen address 127.0.0.1. And that's almost all you need. There might be some other stuff, but I'm actually fairly sure that that's really all you need in your config file for this to work. So we know that the port that it's using is 9050, and you know that the IP address that you should be looking for your little Tor server, essentially, is your local host, 127.0.0.1. So just to test all of this out, the first thing to do, and no, it's not finished yet, don't panic. The first thing that we want to do is, just for kicks, go to whatsmyip.com, or .org, rather. Whatsmyip.org, of course, will show you what your broadcasting as your address is. So in my case, right now, it's 89.233.82.71. Now we've established that. Now open up your preferences in Firefox, edit preferences, go to the network tab in the advanced section, and right at the top it says connection. Configure how Firefox connects to the internet. And if you go into the settings, the connection settings, you have four choices: no proxy, auto detect proxy, use system proxy, or manual proxy. I use the manual proxy, and I just simply type in down at the SOX host, because that's what kind of that's the kind of port or proxy Tor is. It's a SOX proxy. So type in for SOX host list 127.0.0.1, and where it asks you what port to look at, type in 9050. Click OK. Now Firefox, for right now, until you change it, is using a SOX proxy that is pointing at the 9050 port, which is Tor, which is running on your computer. So the IP address of that is 127.0.0.1. Now, if you go to whatsmyip.org, it's going to take a while because you're going probably all over the world. And there it is. Your IP address, 199.131.62.133. Completely different from what your other IP address was. And so now, as long as you're using Firefox, you're now browsing the web completely very anonymously. Of course, Tor will tell you that it's not completely anonymous, quite probably, and you should be very careful. So again, if you're doing this and it's a life-threatening situation, don't listen to this show for all the advice. But that's the simple way to get Tor up and running. It's really, really that easy. And next thing you know, you're going all over the place to get to, you know, whatever site you're really trying to get to. And it's quite a cool experience, and quite a bit slower, so keep that in mind, but it's a good thing to know about. The only other real tip I have, I guess, is a very, very simple command called tcpdump. This is one of those commands that people really could, and, you know, someone really should, especially on a network called Hacker Public Radio, but yeah, someone could and should do an entire series on tcpdump and how to use it. I barely know anything about it, except that if you sit in a cafe and you've got a notebook computer that you can put the Wi-Fi card in monitor mode, and you can use the iwconfig command to put it in monitor mode, or promiscuous mode, some people call it. You can use tcpdump to then monitor all the traffic that is flying through the air anyway. All you're doing is, instead of sending your own signals out, you're just getting everything. You're looking at everything as it passes. It's really cool. And the command for that would be tcpdump -nnv capital X capital S small s 1514. That should get you started anyway. There's a couple of other things you could do, either more or less than that, but that basically turns on a lot of verbosity, and it captures all kinds of packets, I guess, and it also sets how, in what byte sizes you're capturing it in. That's the 1514 part. It's a neat command. You'll see amazing things on the far right-hand column. You'll just see amazing things. You got to try it in a busy cafe where lots of people have their iPhones and their computers out. Do that, and that'll just fascinate you for days, really. Obviously, there's all kinds of places you can go from there. That's like the really most basic thing, and I'm only giving you the most basics because that's as much as I know. You now know as much about tcpdump as I do. People will will tell you, oh, you've got to try Wireshark or T-Shark instead of TCP dump and all these other things. And I totally agree, but I don't know how to, so can't really talk a whole lot about that. But it is fun. I mean, there's cool things like, you know, you can TCP dump -S1514, port 80 -W, you know, TCP 80 dot dump, whatever. Point being that you can tell TCP dump to just capture stuff on port 80, which obviously is going to be all the internet stuff, and it'll ignore all the other extraneous, what we would probably consider noise. I'm sure someone who was really smart and knew what all that noise meant wouldn't call it noise, but there you go. So it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of filtering that you can do in TCP dump alone. I know that there are other programs that filter all this information a lot more effectively and dynamically, but it's kind of cool because you can just see all kinds of traffic flying by your computer. And even if you don't know what it all means, it starts to give you a little bit of a better idea of what exactly all that traffic really is. All kinds of interesting things to just look at. And for what you're doing just for fun, I don't pretend that this is like anything evil or subversive at all. It's because it's not. It's really just monitoring traffic. And happily, most people most sites, important sites, encrypt their traffic. So you're not even going to see stuff unless you really, really know what you're doing and really, really try to see it. But you will see interesting stuff nevertheless. You know, idle conversations on GChat sometimes, but not really any passwords or anything. I mean, unless you're really looking for it. I'm not really looking for it. I miss all that stuff. I think it's just cool to look at these little packet headers and all the, and really what makes all this data that's flying through the air to get reconstructed, you know, to get routed and then reconstructed. It's a very cool study. So you should definitely do that. I mean, if you're going to be sitting outside on a public network, you kind of owe it to yourself and, you know, to the network to monitor it. It's just cool. Now, on that subject, there is a cool little device that you can get from a place called MetaGeek. That's MetaGeek. And it's called the Wi-Spy. And that name sounds a lot more subversive, again, than it really is. The Wi-Spy is a little antenna, and that really is all it is. It's an antenna that you plug into your USB port, and the device monitors the level of traffic on different frequencies. It is not a full spectrum analyzer. It's not analyzing all possible spectrum, you know, all possible frequencies on that frequency chart, you know, the FCC kind of runs. It's just monitoring Wi-Fi traffic range. And it does this with two different tools. There's an incurses interface and there's a GUI interface. And both of them are fairly easy to install on Linux. You have to kind of do it from source code. Well, actually, I think that might be available for Debian or something, but I generally just do it from the source that's included on the disk that you get with the antenna, or if you don't get a disk or you don't have a disk, you can download it from the project's website, which is a SourceForge project. It wouldn't do you any good without the device, though. It's a front end, you know, it's a soft interface for this little piece of hardware. So you plug the USB antenna into your USB connection, it becomes just a monitor of frequency traffic, and you can then find out where in the frequency spectrum you might find more or less stuff to either monitor or compete with, depending on your goal. So if it's a setup where you've got lots of choices of which public network you're going to join or whatever, then you can choose your channel accordingly. Or if you just want to find out where most of the traffic is, that's a really quick and easy way to monitor where all the action is happening. It's a really fairly quick and drastic, noticeable thing. I mean, it gives you a little chart, and the stuff that's really, really busy just peaks up really quick. You'll see it right away, and you can jump onto that channel if you want, or you can avoid that channel if your goal is to stay off the noisy networks and enjoy a little bit of peace and quiet. So that's MetaGeek, and the product is called Wi-Spy. Of course, having a little antenna popping out of your notebook could be a little bit suspicious looking, don't you think? Well, interestingly, you'd think so, and actually, a lot of people don't ever seem to notice it at all, and those who do assume that it's a cellular modem. So it's actually not that suspicious. However, that is one thing that you'd want to keep in mind. As I've said in previous episodes, keeping up an appearance of some kind of normalcy is actually really important to an urban camper. You don't want to arouse suspicion or disapproval or anything like that if your goal is to find peace and quiet and places to hang around and potentially get free food or really cheap food or just a place to stay out of the heat or the cold, whatever. So having a little USB antenna popping out of your laptop might be fine in some areas. It might not be in other areas. Having your computer on while you're just sitting in your car outside of a residential house, you might not be doing anything at all suspicious. You might be sharing their network. You might not be. It just depends. Point being, that kind of thing tends to draw attention to you. So be smart about it, I guess, is what I'm really trying to get to here. The goal here is not to look like a cool superhero evil hacker. The goal is to be a good computerist, to be a good hacker, to sit down and get your work done, be smart about it, be safe about it, protect your data on the way out to the network and back, and learn about it and study it, and that's it. So that's what I tend to like to do, and I tend to be very mindful of, for instance, how glowy my laptop screen is when I'm out at night in places that would raise some suspicion if I'm seen just kind of hanging out for hours at a time outside of some place with a glowing laptop screen, or, you know, sitting in some place where maybe they're a little bit sensitive about the security of their network, and here you are scanning it with an antenna poking out of your laptop, kind of asking for trouble. So you shouldn't ask for trouble. Overall, I think that urban camping and kind of hanging around places, exploring different networks, exploring different ways to protect yourself from people who are smarter than you on that same network, and how to just kind of be smart about the way that you are transmitting your data, since all of us hackers are supposedly so computer savvy and we all want to protect data and all this other good stuff. If you're unfamiliar with these basic tools like SSH tunneling and I guess Tor and how to set up a proxy, just little things like that, I don't know. It seems like there's a breach of what you're saying and what you're doing there. So being an urban camper and actually being able to explore how do I implement these things, it's really powerful stuff. And I think of all the things of urban camping in terms of learning stuff, having a lot of time to really explore all the different things that the hacker culture is always talking about, the community is always talking about, like the security and all the cool things that you can do on a network and all these things and servers and all that good stuff. A lot of it happened during urban camping for me because I could sit down and I could focus, and I had a different environment every day if I wanted. You know, I had all kinds of different things going on. I'd have different problems pop up quite unexpectedly when all I'm trying to do is sign on to my server to check an email. You know, there'd be some weird issue, some random cookie that someone wants to give me that maybe I don't want to accept, an SSL cert check that I'm not doing when I'm checking my mutt mail that maybe I should be checking the SSL. Maybe I should learn how to download that SSL cert and actually utilize it so that I'm signing into the same server every time. Little tiny details like that, you can start really concentrating on them, because no longer are you kind of complacent in your own home where, hey, you're wired straight to Comcast or Verizon or whatever big evil corporation you're hooking into for your internet. You're not there anymore. You're doing cool, different things. You're dealing with different network setups. You're looking at the way one sysadmin or you know, the guy who knows how to make the internet work at one cafe set up their network versus the corporate setup that some franchise has. It's really interesting study, and it's just as interesting as the people that you'll meet when you're urban camping and the different experiences you'll have when you're urban camping. The computing side of it, it gets really interesting really fast if you let yourself go along that path and study it and think about it and learn more about it. So that's yet one more recommendation on why you might want to urban camp, because the computing becomes a lot more fun. So look into all of those things. Look into a VPS or a server that you can use. Look into configuring your mail so that you're actually not sending plain text passwords or whatever, or even usernames. Look into getting someplace that you can SSH into. Set up Tor, start using TCP dump, and email me. Let me know how it's all going. Email me tips. Email me stuff that you've learned, whatever. And most of all, just remember that urban camping is exactly what I didn't realize, but I think all of us actually do realize it. I think the hacker community, at least the HPR listeners who I've heard from, have been really, really open to the idea, really, really excited about the idea. And I think it's, for lack of a better description. It's hacking society. It's hacking the status quo. You're taking exactly what people want you to live your life in a certain way, and you're taking that and you're not going with it at all. You're doing what you want to on your own terms. And that's really exciting stuff, because that's how things get done. We do it ourselves, right? We change our own lives. We change the way that we do things. We learn stuff on our own, and then we do whatever we want to. And that's freedom, I guess. So enjoy that freedom, and thanks again for listening to this mini-series, the Hacker Public Radio mini-series on urban camping. Talk to you next time.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.